1000. That's 713-526-4000, extension 315. You can help to ensure that the independent voice of KPFT will be preserved for generations to come. Please name KPFT as a beneficiary in your will today. This is KPFT Houston.
Beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch, the sound that signals that it's Thursday 10 p.m. and time for us to ease on in to So What's Your Story? We're the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and we're right here on listener-sponsored 90.1 KPFT Houston. Hi, I'm Warren Holloman, Professor of Behavioral Science at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. I'll be hosting tonight's show. And I'm here with my partner in crime, Jacob Reiner, who's working the boards. Hi, Jacob.
How are you doing tonight, sir?
Great. Are you having a good New Year so far?
I am. How's your New Year's?
Can't complain. It's been really good.
Good.
The reason you and I do this show, of course, is that we love to tell stories, and we love to hear other people tell stories. We believe that every day of every life is a story worth telling, and we believe that telling stories brings people together. It deepens relationships, and it builds communities. We believe that storytelling connects us to our past, and it directs us toward our future. And we believe that every good story has the power to infuse our lives with meaning and with purpose, with happiness and with healing. And speaking of happiness, and especially of healing, tonight's guest storyteller is a professional healer, a physician to be more specific. She's Dr. Mary Edgerton, a pathologist at MD Anderson Cancer Center. Mary, good evening, and welcome to So What's Your Story?
Hey, Warren. It's great to be here with you.
Well, I'm delighted that you're here. We're going to have a good time together. I guess at the outset, I just got to ask, what exactly does a pathologist do?
Well, I know everybody thinks all we do are autopsies, but actually most of what I work with are specimens that come out of the operating room. So basically anything that comes out of the human body comes to pathology, and we check it and we try to figure out what's going on with it. And so most of what I'm dealing with are bits and pieces from living people. And as I say, when I get the body in toto, it's after the fact.
Yeah, so it's not exactly what we see on CSI?
No, not.
But it's still very serious and very important.
It is very serious and important, and I specialize in breast cancer. And in fact, I want people to understand pathology better, and so I've written a book called A Pocket Guide to Cancer that explains the terms that are used and how information is used to determine a patient's treatment, and so that a patient can be better informed and to give them questions that they can ask their doctors.
And where can we get that book?
You can get that book off Amazon. Just go to Amazon, Mary Edgerton, A Pocket Guide to Cancer, and it'll come up.
Great. Okay. Well, you're working in the largest medical center in the world, but you began your life in a town I've never even heard of.
Rio Grande City, Texas, which still has less people than the number of people working at MD Anderson, for sure.
And I'm guessing it's not on the Oklahoma border?
No, it is not on the Oklahoma border. It is a river city, but it's down. It's about halfway between Brownsville and Laredo. And it was the third poorest county in the USA while I was growing up. It's now the fifth poorest. And I'd say probably about 75% of the population were migrant farm workers who picked cantaloupe and watermelon, starting down there in the valley and then going all the way up to Seattle, Washington, and then coming back down for the next year.
Right. So what was it like growing up in a place like that?
Well, everybody is poor, and even the middle class are poor. And as I start to tell you my story, I wanted to give you a little background. So when we first moved there, we lived in this old house. And there were, the house had been a dry goods store with an apartment on top. Uh-huh. And my grandmother in the 1940s remodeled it into 2 one-bedroom apartments. And uh-huh. one bedroom was at one far end downstairs and the other bedroom at the other far end upstairs. So when we moved there, and we were 5, 7, and 9, uh-huh. my dad said, well, I can't have our kids at one end of the house and us at the other. So we lived in one-bedroom apartment. And so there were 5 of us. My parents slept in the bedroom. We had 1 bathroom, which was a little bit of a problem as we went through our teenage years.
Right.
The 3 kids slept in the living room and dining room. So they'd make it out a sofa bed and a trundle bed every night, move out the coffee table out of the way. And dinner was at the coffee table. Uh-huh. So the 5 of us sat around this, and it was a low coffee table. If you were one of the 2 people on the sofa, you hated it because you had to splay your knees wide apart to be able to lean over your plate. Otherwise, you were in a captain's chair leaning over, and the prime seat was a camel saddle that one of my aunts had left us after she'd been to Africa. So, oh, wow. But we thought that was normal.
Yeah.
That's how we grew up.
So your story that you're going to tell us now is actually about something very normal and very non-exciting, it would seem, a refrigerator. But the subtitle is of your story is A Chink in the Armor.
So, yes. So that little background I gave you was just to give you an idea of what we considered normal. Mm-hmm. After all, we did have an indoor toilet, and not everybody in our neighborhood did. And a lot of people had big families living in single-room houses. Mm-hmm. So we had this refrigerator, and my mother was on a constant mission to make our house look better. She'd constantly walk around saying, I know we're poor, but we live in genteel poverty. So our old 1940s refrigerator began to rust, and so she said, well, I'm going to paint this bright white again and make it nice. And she went down and she bought some primer, and she bought some white paint. And we'd have to go to a store about 40 miles away, McAllen, to buy things like this. And she spent the day working on it, and she had the top part primed. And I don't know if you remember those 1940s refrigerators had a little container at the bottom where you could store sacks and things uh-huh. to reuse. So by the time we got home from school and my father came home from the ranch, the bottom was white, and the top part was a splotchy primer avocado green. And if you might remember, in the 1960s, avocado green was the color right. for refrigerators. And so my father said, you know, I think I like that avocado green better. And my mother said, well, you know, George, that's okay, but I threw away all the cans of primer. And he said, not a problem. Next time we're in McAllen, we'll just stop at the paint store and pick one up. So we got there, and we couldn't quite identify the avocado green, and so we bought a green. And Warren, this went on for years. About once a month, we'd go and we'd buy a can and we'd splotch it on and say, well, that's Hunter Green, not the right color. That's too yellow. That's lemony. That's too bright. That's too dark. So pretty soon, our refrigerator kind of looked like a Jackson Pollock painting. And then it broke. The latch broke. And my father said, well, the refrigerator still works. The compressor still works. And, of course, we didn't have eBay to go get parts on. So he says, no problem. We'll just use a little masking tape and keep it shut. So he'd put on a couple of pieces of masking tape, and the adhesive would get a little weak, and he'd put on a couple more, and we'd have anywhere between 5 and 7 pieces of masking tape holding this Jackson Pollock door onto our refrigerator. And we thought that was just normal. In fact, we kids would come home and come up the stairs for cold water, and we'd be pulling back that tape because it was hot outside. Whick, whick, whick. And my father would come back from the bedroom saying, no wonder we go through so many rolls of masking tape. And he would close these up and say, you have to take it off slowly. Okay, so we learned. And then one day, my brother's best friend came home with us. And my brother and I are there just pulling away the tape, this time slowly, carefully, to get the cold water. And I looked at him, and his eyes were big like saucers. And he said, John, what happened to your refrigerator? And it's the first time I looked at it and said, oh, I guess that's a little odd. And that's when you kind of begin to realize a chink in the armor. Maybe your family isn't the center of normalcy in the world. Uh-huh. So that was what our childhood was like. Quite different. Yeah.
That's a great story, because you take something so ordinary and then it becomes kind of a metaphor for your family.
It was a metaphor for us. It was splotchy. It was a lot of procrastination built into it.
Yeah, yeah.
And taped up together.
Yeah, yeah. And at the time, it just seemed like a refrigerator.
Oh, it was our refrigerator. That's where our food was. It was just, I stopped noticing all the different splotches.
How far did you have to get away from Rio Grande City before you realized that most refrigerators didn't look like that?
Oh, well, you know, you go to college and you live in a dorm and you never really see a refrigerator.
Yeah.
And I think I must have been in my 20s before I began to look back on my life and say, you know, I think we were a little odd. Mm-hmm. And one day I said to one of my cousins at a family reunion a few years ago, I said, you know, Robin, I think our family's a little strange. Mm-hmm. And she said, oh, we are. We are. So...
Well, do you ever wonder what appliance in your current home might hold special meaning for your children 10 or 20 or 30 years from now?
You know, I've thought about that because not a single one of our refrigerators has been splotchy colored like that for sure. Not at all. And I think, though, that we as parents try to correct what we found to be the mistakes or holes in mm-hmm. our childhood. Mm-hmm. And so my kitchen looks very nice and all mm-hmm. the appliances are modern and new. And I say to myself, they're going to be telling a story about something completely different that I've completely missed because I'm not thinking about it.
Right. So you say the subtitle is The Chink in the Armor. Say a little more about that.
Well, you know, like I say, you grow up saying, my family's normal.
Uh-huh.
I mean, everybody else is strange,
uh-huh.
but
uh-huh.
we are the center of normal. And
yeah.
it's just that day when you suddenly sit down and say, gee, people think our refrigerator is weird, and nobody has one like this.
Right.
I wonder if we're really the center of normal.
Yeah.
And so that's where it begins. And so you start to look at your life and maybe want something different. And that's where I began to say, you know, I'm going to move far away from here. I'm going to live in New York City, and I'm going to have a different life, and it's going to be interesting every day.
Where is that avocado refrigerator now?
You know, I was looking for it. It's out and rusted and sitting out at our ranch. And there are a few things that we won't throw away. One is our old pickup truck that we kept forever, and the other one is the old refrigerator. It's a symbol.
Yeah.
It's very
yeah.
important.
Oh, I love that story. I love it. Thank you so much. If you're just joining us, this is Warren Holloman with Jacob Reiner, and you're listening to So What's Your Story? We're here with guest storyteller Dr. Mary Edgerton on listener-sponsored, corporate-free, 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. If you're in Galveston, you can find us at 89.5, and in Livingston at 90.3. All our support comes from you, our listeners, and without that support, we don't stay on the air. Jacob?
That's right. It costs about $75 to produce each edition of our show. So if you want to support us, you can call us right now at 713-526-KPFT, or you can donate online. Go to our website at www.kpft.org. But please be sure to indicate that your donation is for So What's Your Story?
Jacob and I, along with Hank, Greg, and Laura, like to think our show is one of the best things going in terms of promoting the art of storytelling here in Houston. But we know there's a lot of other good stuff going on out there.
Yeah, for example, there's the monthly story swap hosted by our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. In case you haven't heard, beginning this month, there's a new schedule and new location. The story swaps are now the fourth Tuesday of the month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the Museum of Printing History. The museum is in the Montrose community on West Clay near the intersection of Waugh Drive and West Dallas. Get all the essential information at www.houstonstorytellers.org.
So from now on, the fourth Tuesday?
Yes. So starting this month, it would be January 26th.
Great. And I think we should also put in a plug for our own Dr. Hank. Jacob, tell us about the workshop he's doing in collaboration with the Houston Storytellers Guild.
Absolutely. Well, this Saturday, January 9th, our show's founder and longtime host, Dr. Hank Rubicek, will be leading a storytelling workshop for beginners at Midtown Bar and Grill. It's on 415 West Gray from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. This is an incredible opportunity to learn from our own storytelling guru, and also just to meet others who enjoy stories. I promise you'll have a ton of fun.
I think everybody has the heart of a storyteller inside. those who are young, those who are old, those who are introverts, those who are extroverts. Dr. Hank's workshop will help you find that inner storyteller, just like Mary and all the other great storytelling guests we have on this show. If you want to learn more about the workshop, go again to the website, www.houstonstorytellers.org.
And speaking of our storytelling guests, next week we have Rabbi Laura hosting, and her guest will be Ruth Ebenstein. She is an Israeli journalist, and she will be talking about her struggle with breast cancer.
Thanks, Jake. And now back to tonight's guest, who just happens to be a breast cancer physician and pathologist. Mary, I have to say, I loved your story about growing up in Rio Grande City. It reminded me a little bit of the stories I hear from Garrison Keillor, who talks about his hometown as being the little town that time forgot out on the edge of the prairie. Is Rio Grande City such a place?
Well, it is a little town that time forgot. I do love listening to Garrison Keillor's stories, and maybe some of the things I used to hear my mother say, such as, if you do that, you're going to put your eye out. He's got a great story about that. Or a little like that. Rio Grande City is quite different, though. It's somewhere between the United States and Mexico. And, of course, with all the migrant farm workers, that gives it a different flavor. Growing up, I felt very cheated because we didn't have a movie theater. Our family didn't have a television. The town didn't have a swimming pool. There was no city library. And I thought, well, there's just really nothing to do here. But what I was missing was this background, which now is wonderful to remember, of, say, Eugene Nelson coming and organizing the migrant farm workers. He was a lieutenant of Cesar Chavez. The flood that Hurricane Beulah brought us, and going from a population of 5,000 to 15,000. But going back to that beginning, in that period when I thought I was being cheated, as I said before, I said, you know, when I get out of here, watch my dust. I'm going to Manhattan. I'm going to San Francisco. I'm going everywhere. I'm marrying somebody from outside the state. And in fact, I did. I married a man from Brooklyn. And we had two children. He had two children from a previous marriage. And I thought, well, everything seemed to be going okay. Maybe a little weird, but, you know, I had by this time accepted that no family is normal. Although I thought mine was more normal, my new family was more normal than my own childhood family had been. Except one night, I guess it was a night before our 10th wedding anniversary. This was in 2000. And I followed him downstairs after putting our 4- and 6-year-old, 7-year-old to bed. And I said, you know, what's going on? You're just being really weird. Are you having an affair or something? Of course, expecting the answer to be no. And he turns around and he says, yes, as a matter of fact, I am. You know, Warren, I just felt as though this double sensation of my heart clenching shut, and at the same time about to beat out of my chest. Then at the same time, of course, being a pathologist, and, you know, we do cut open people to see why they died, I start asking all these probing questions. Well, were you in love with her? Were there any others? And I'm getting all these yes answers and yes answers, and this isn't really going well. And I finally decided just to go take a little walk around the block, around the house. And I walked around the house, and I thought my head felt a little clearer, and I walked up to the front porch, and I sat on it, and he came outside, and I turned around to him, and I said, you know, I think this could go one of two ways. We can either go to a therapist, you quit this relationship, and we can try to put this back together, or we'll get a divorce. And he starts saying, well, I don't know. You know, I need to ask my aunt. His mother had died. And I need to ask my sister. And I thought to myself, you know what? I don't need to ask anybody. And so I just went inside the house and started separating out our little collections of things on the shelves. And he came in and said, what are you doing? I said, well, we're getting a divorce. And he said, we are? And I guess he hadn't realized that I could also make that decision. I said, yes, we are. You're not going to end it. And so he started pacing, and I was separating. I was having a good time. I was wide awake. It was about midnight and had a lot of energy. And he said, well, what's going to happen to me, and what's going to happen to my tools in the garage? And I said, I don't know. It's not my problem anymore. And so he paced a while, and he came back and said, okay, okay, I'll break it off with her. So I said, okay, you need to send her an email tonight, and you need to do it in front of me. And he said, why do I need to do it in front of you? And I said, well, really? Yes, like, I believe you, duh. And so he said, well, he started panicking a little bit, I think, and he said, I really don't think you want to see the email. And then I saw why, because there was a little pornographic exchange going on between the two of them. Anyway, the next day I went to see my doctor to get the name of a marital therapist, and she said, she's talking to me, and she says, well, is there a gun in the house? And I said, oh, there is, but you know, I don't think he's going to shoot me. And she looks at me and she says, no, not him, you. And I looked at her and I started thinking, lady, you need to ask me if there's a bat in the house, because a gun is just instantaneous. Too fast. Beat him to death is what I have in mind. I didn't say that, though. Anyway, so we went on. We started this journey of marital therapy, and I cut my hair to where it was a quarter inch all over. Sometimes I used a number one blade. I lost 45 pounds, and then, of course, shortly after, 9/11 happened. And I just felt as though everything in my life had fallen apart. What I thought was my family, the center of my little sense of security universe, was gone. My country and my sense of security in my country was gone. I just everything felt as though it had broken away. And while I was wondering whether or not I was doing the right thing, staying with him or not, I could hear the voices of all these women, men and women, really saying, your spouse made a mistake and wants to come back and make it up with you. I will never see mine again. Mm-hmm. What are you thinking? Mm-hmm. Go back. Yeah. I would want to be in your position. Yeah. And so, although, you know, I knew my children wanted us to stay together, and I could feel that, it was really the voice of all these people, the sense of all these people saying, you're really lucky. You really are lucky. And so I stayed. And I stayed, and there were good moments. The kids did grow up with an intact family. There were other bizarre things. But about a decade later, that old alarm clock was ringing again in that man. And I came home from a business trip, and he said, he sat on our bed, and he said, I want a divorce. I want to go have sex with as many women as possible. And I thought, wow, that's a great way of introducing it. And so
he was from New York. I guess he got to the point.
He got straight to the point. He was a man from Brooklyn. Although he didn't seem to understand when I said, well, I think you should go sleep in the guest bedroom tonight. And he said, really? Not in this bed? I said, no. And so I asked him to leave by that weekend. And I did a check with the thousands of voices again, and we agreed this is not the droid you want. We could let him go now. Right. And so it was a 23-year marriage, and it was over within about 2.5 months. We were divorced. And I have to say, I feel great. I date. Yeah. I feel wonderful. I have a better relationship with my kids than I've ever had before. They now see the two of us separately and understand what each of us brings to the table. And my self-esteem, it's been a couple of years since, right, you know, since that happened. But I have to say to anybody out there going through this, give it time. It will be okay. I have been through it twice.
Oh, wow. For those of you who are just joining us, you're enjoying guest storyteller Dr. Mary Edgerton on So What's Your Story? Only on 90.1 KPFT Houston. Mary, I have to say that story was quite different from the first story and quite painful to listen to. I'm wondering what it was like for you to be the teller of the story.
Well, as I tell it now, Warren, I think it really gives me empowerment, uh-huh, over the event.
Right.
The first time that he was unfaithful, my self-esteem was hit hard. I kept wondering, how did I walk on the set of this movie? This was not the script I thought I signed up for. You know? What was my agent thinking? And it it was hard to admit to myself. And I would actually sit and practice the word cuckold. You're cuckold. What do you think of that? You're cuckold. And that was rather unpleasant. And the second time I thought, you know what? I am moving on. I'm up and out of here. And as I tell the story, I own it. It no longer owns me. I don't have to practice those words. I own it.
Right.
And it has no power over me. I have my self-esteem more and more as I tell the story.
That's an incredible concept of the story behind the story, or the process of the story, that it is an empowering thing to be the one who tells the story, because you can shape the narrative now.
Yes, yes. And I've emerged.
Yeah.
I've emerged from this cocoon of being afraid to talk about it or being unable to talk about it to saying, yes, it happened. It actually happened to me. I was on the set of that movie. I can watch it like a movie, and I'm okay now.
So there's a distanciation.
Yes.
To some extent. Yes. That the story gives you. If you had been on this show 2 years ago, would you have told the story differently?
2 years ago, I was starting to tell it because I could tell people, you know, my husband of 23 years sat on my bed and said he wanted to have sex with as many women as possible. And people would say, what? I did go through a phase where I referred to him as my sperm donor. Mm-hmm. And then I finally decided, you know, I can let that go. He was my ex-husband. He cheated on me. That's what happened. But I think that when the first event happened, say back in 2000, then that one was would have been too hard.
Mm-hmm. And what about your children? What's their story?
And have I missed 9/11? Was it 2001? I think I'm getting old. It was 2001. You know, for my children, I think when they first heard about it, it wasn't as though they didn't know that there was some chink in the armor of our marriage. Mm-hmm. But what has happened is, I mentioned before, they've gotten to know us as two different people. They knew us as together, battling over things, one person's bias describing the other, and now they know us as two individual people. Mm-hmm. And I have a closer relationship than ever with them than ever before. And my two stepsons, who'd been with us for so many years, both called me up and said, you've been in my life this long. You're not leaving. You're still in my life.
That's a nice next chapter. It pretends of a positive future.
Definitely.
Mary, I've enjoyed getting to know you better tonight, and I'm sure our listeners have as well. Thank you for being on So What's Your Story.
Oh, well, thank you, Warren, for having me.
I want to thank you for joining us tonight. You've shared from your very interesting life, childhood innocence, adult betrayal, and you've been so vulnerable. You've treated us to some fine art, the art of storytelling. You've also reminded us that the seemingly most insignificant features of our childhood can hold abundant meaning for us as adults. And you've also, of course, spoken of the emotional and spiritual torment of adult betrayal. But you've given us hope that there can be life beyond the suffering, that there can be a collateral gain to buffet the collateral damage, and that there can be redemption and not simply revenge. And if I might add one more thing, you're a doctor. I spend most of my time working with doctors. I think you've reminded us that doctors, those people who are supposed to always be on the giving side of the healing equation, who are supposed to always be well and never get sick, you've reminded us that doctors are people who have real lives, real problems, real feelings, and they need love just like everyone else.
Oh, well, thank you, Warren. That is so true.
Thank you, my friend. Well, Scooter is up next with the inner side to complete the backside of this Power Hour on KPFT. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 10 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And ease into the weekend right. Keep loving a great story, and we'll keep bringing them to you. Be good to each other. Till next week, Hank, Greg, Laura, Jacob, Mary, and I remind you that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace. How sweet it is to be loved by you.
Thank you to everyone who gave during our December year-end campaign. Your contributions in December brought KPFT to a high we have never seen before. The previous year, spirits were high when Houston came together and boosted KPFT with $30,000 in gifts. You more than tripled that this year and we're very thankful. Whether it's the elections or the exciting cultural landscape, 2016 is going to be an important year. If you missed your chance to give, you still can anytime at kpft.org. Thanks for your support of independent music, ideas, arts, and culture. This is 90.1.